Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I'm Margaret Brennan in Washington, and this week on Face the Nation, pressure builds to try and get the Hamas-held hostage negotiations back on track, and campus protests sparked by the Israel-Hamas conflict spread across the country. On Saturday, more Hamas proof-of-life propaganda featuring another American hostage held in Gaza, appearing very much under duress. President Biden vows that he will not rest until every hostage is returned and sends his top diplomat back to the region. Plus, with $61 billion in aid now headed to Ukraine, Republican leader Mitch McConnell apologizes to Volodymyr Zelensky for Senate Republicans' role in that delay that took its toll on the country's war effort.
Do you feel your party is responsible for those setbacks?
Many of them, yeah. We took too long.
Plus, what's helping fuel those campus protests from coast to coast? We'll tell you. It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We begin today with foreign correspondent Deborah Pata in Jerusalem.
Like most days in Rafah, this one began with mourning.
Allahu Akbar.
After more Israeli strikes hit what is mostly a tent city in the south, sheltering over half of Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinians crammed up against the Egyptian border. There were heartbreaking farewells to tiny bodies wrapped in shrouds. This infant has known only war her entire life. It's been a brutal week for children. Even miracle baby Sabrine Al-Ru, who was saved from her dying mother's womb a week ago, lived just 5 days. She's been buried next to the rest of her family. Rafah is already under daily bombardment, but Israel keeps threatening a ground invasion. And Palestinians who've already fled multiple times keep asking, where will they go? Much of Gaza lies in ruin. The destruction on such a scale, it is uninhabitable. This morning, more humanitarian aid was airdropped over the territory, and this IDF footage shows the floating pier being built by the Americans near the Gazan coastline, which officials say will be completed early May, allowing more supplies to flow into Gaza. But the dire warnings of imminent famine have not gone away. Already, the UN says one in three children under the age of two is acutely malnourished. Prior to October 7, hardly any. And despite an increase in aid, the UN says it is still not enough to avert famine, which could spread across the north next month.
Ahead of a possible Rafah invasion, there are now last-ditch attempts to revive ceasefire talks. Hamas has stepped up the pressure by releasing propaganda videos that show three hostages, including two Americans, still alive but speaking under duress.
Our Deborah Pata in Jerusalem, and we are joined now by Hannah Siegel, whose uncle Keith Siegel is one of those American hostages. Good morning to you, Hannah.
Good morning, Margaret. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for speaking to us. I know that the Biden administration has reached out to you and your family. The FBI is analyzing that video released yesterday. What stood out to you? I think this is the first proof of life so far.
We've always believed that he's alive. We have to believe that he's alive. And his wife, my aunt, Aviva Siegel, who was held for 52 days, released in the deal that took place in November. She was with him, and so we knew when she came out, she told us that he was alive. But this is the first time that we're seeing him, that we're hearing him. It's surreal.
And you have 205 there. That's the number of days he has been held. In the video, your uncle, under duress, mentions the protests that have been taking place in Israel, pressuring the government for a deal. Do you think that a deal can be reached at this point, and is it up to the United States to close it?
I do think a deal can be reached. I mean, we know that. A deal was reached in November. Dozens of women and children were released, including my aunt, Aviva Siegel. So we know that it's possible, and I do think that's really important to remember. The United States plays a critical role. It played a critical role in November. I think, you know, ultimately, this is a negotiation between Hamas and Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. And one of the things that really worries my family and worries me is that it's arguably not in Prime Minister Netanyahu's political interest to close a deal. And, you know, for us, this is the moment. These videos, as you know, there was a video released a couple of days ago of another American hostage, Hirsch Goldberg-Polin. Mm-hmm. I do think that these two videos are a signal from Hamas that they are ready to make a deal and a reminder that there are American citizens being held, including Keith.
There are 133 hostages that we know of, five of them Americans. Why do you believe it is not in Prime Minister Netanyahu's interest to cut a deal to bring them home?
I think, you know, there is a lot swirling in the political landscape in Israel, and I'm not here to talk about that, but there have been negotiations going on for months now. We're at 205 days. There have been deals on the table, and they've proven elusive, and I worry that that is because of Prime Minister Netanyahu. So I think that now is the moment. I think I have faith that we can do a deal now, but I also think that if that isn't possible, then the Biden administration should think about what they can do directly to bring our American citizens home.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is flying to the region now and is going to talk about a ceasefire and a hostage deal. Do you know if the Biden administration is considering making a deal to bring the Americans home without the Israeli government's approval or role here?
I don't know.
But you want them to look at that option.
What I know is that the Biden administration has shown unwavering and relentless commitment to my family and the families of all of the hostages. And I know that it is their priority to bring all hostages, including the Americans, home. And so I know that they are doing absolutely everything that they can. Keith, in this video, I mean, he starts the video by saying how much he loves us, he loves our family, and he's obviously under duress. He's gaunt, he looks weak, but that's real. I know that he misses his family. He talks about, you know, I think the hardest part of the video is he breaks down talking about being alone on Passover. Those of us Siegels in America got together for Passover, and those in Israel got together for Passover, and we had this little picture of Keith at the table, but he's not home. And so I have such faith, and I have felt the commitment from the Biden administration to get him back.
Keith's daughter sent a recorded message to protesters who were in the streets in Israel last night. And she said, I demand the country's leaders watch the video and see their father crying for help. Hamas released this as propaganda. Why do you think watching that video is important? What do you think is not understood by the government?
First of all, my cousins, Keith's kids, and his wife, of course, a hostage survivor herself, are incredibly brave, and they have spent every single day going to anybody who will listen around the world and telling them, reminding them that there are people's lives at stake. I think there's so much swirling in the political realm that it's easy to forget that these are human beings. Keith is a grandfather. He's a husband. He's a brother. He's an uncle. We're a very, very close family. And that's what we're feeling. More than any of the political considerations, more than thinking about the day after and what happens, those are really, really important questions. But I think this video is a reminder that these are human beings and they need to come home.
The U.S. says Hamas is standing in the way of a deal. Are you concerned that if an invasion of southern Gaza, of Rafah, happens, that your uncle will be at risk of death?
Very concerned. I mean, he talks in the video about hearing bombs all around him.
Yeah.
And so we worry about the fact that he's being held underground by a terrorist group, of course. We worry about the fact that he's starving. When Aviva came out, she talked to us about how they were beginning to starve. And I can't imagine that that hasn't gotten so much worse. You can see it on his face. And we also worry about the bombs going off around him.
Of course. Hannah, thank you for reminding us about the humanity here. And we wish you luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
We visited Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell on Capitol Hill Thursday, just after he apologized to President Zelensky for the delay passing the $61 billion aid package for Ukraine. Leader McConnell acknowledged to us the six-month process, four in the Senate, was a costly delay for the Ukrainian war effort. In the time of the delay, Russia's military land forces have grown back to where they were before the invasion. The army's 15% larger, and they've reinforced the 20% of Ukrainian territory that they hold. These are all the words of the Supreme Allied Commander himself. Do you feel your party is responsible for those setbacks?
Many of them, yeah. We took too long. This issue was like a family reunion, if you will, with a lot of different points of view being expressed around the table. All the Democrats were for Ukraine. There's no question that the debate was in our family, on our side, and there was a lot of skepticism for a long time, but I think it got better. Mm-hmm. And I think we proved that earlier this week.
What do you think changed minds?
The actual facts. Once we realized we were not going to get a border result, I think our members really started focusing on the package. It was clear then it was not going to have a border provision attached to it. And there are almost no good arguments against this. Every argument that was made by the opponents is provably wrong. And the facts, I think, were convincing for a number of our members. And they changed their minds.
You are leader for another 8 months. But you've said you're going to stay and serve out your term. Donald Trump may again become president. According to our latest CBS polling, 79% of self-identified Republicans told us that the source of information they most trust on Ukraine and Russia is Donald Trump. This sentiment doesn't seem to be disappearing. How are you going to counter that?
What I want to do and what I've focused on is not the presidential race, but getting the Senate back.
But this isn't the race. This is persuading public opinion.
Yeah, I think the single most important thing I can do is make sure my successor is the majority leader, no matter how the presidential election comes out. I think the fact that our nominee basically decided not to continue whipping people against the package was a good sign. And I'm going to be advocating increasing the defense budget, no matter who gets elected, and preparing ourselves for the long term, which is China, Russia, and Iran. This administration budget requests for defense haven't even kept up with inflation.
You said the Republican nominee decided not to whip against the package. In other words, stop telling lawmakers that not to vote for it. But we know Donald Trump is not a fan of Zelensky. Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, recently had dinner with Mr. Trump at Mar-a-Lago and then told reporters that Trump said he won't give a penny to Ukraine, and that'll be the way he forces an end to the fighting. If that's the fundamental belief of the man who's going to be commander-in-chief, how do you stop him?
What I'm doing is trying to change the Senate so that we have a majority, no matter who wins the presidential election. I can't control that. I have some influence here in the Senate. I intend to use it, no matter who gets elected president, to increase our defense budget and get ready for the challenges that we have ahead of us.
But that's a challenge where you might have to be the firewall against your own party and its leader again.
I've been willing to do that. I had something to do with changing opinion in the Senate on this issue, and I think a lot more of my members now understand the importance of it.
About a month after January 6th, you voted to acquit Donald Trump after he was impeached. And you said on the Senate floor, Trump
didn't get away with anything yet. We have a criminal justice system in this country. We have civil litigation. And former presidents are not immune from being accountable by either one.
Do you still believe that former presidents are not completely immune from liability?
Let's put it this way. I addressed that issue on February the 13th.
It's active before the Supreme Court as we speak.
And January the 6th of 2021. I stand by everything I said then. Obviously, it'll be up to the Supreme Court to decide whether I was correct.
Part of what you said is part of this case in some ways, because you argued for the Senate not to convict Mr. Trump. And central to his immunity argument is the claim that a former president who was impeached and convicted by the Senate can be criminally prosecuted. He was not. Do you regret your choice? It's part of the defense.
I don't regret anything I said then. I haven't taken anything I said then back. But the answer to your question is going to be in the courts. The Supreme Court's going to decide that.
So you stand by your description of Trump as practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of January 6th and potentially criminally responsible and liable?
I don't know how many times you're going to ask me the same question. I stand by everything I said on January 6th and February 13th of 21.
Well, I'm asking you the question because since the past few months have passed in our last conversation, you've endorsed him for re-election.
You need to get better research. I was asked that question 3 years ago. If he were the nominee, would I support him?
And you said you would support whoever the nominee
yes,
was.
Because the voters of my party across the country have made a decision. As the Republican leader of the Senate, obviously I'm going to support the nominee of our party.
But you have taken stands on issues you feel are of a strong national security interest and morally imperative. That was your argument on Ukraine. And that you were bucking, in some ways, a populist opinion. So on this one, I'm just wondering how you explain that when you say it was good enough for a number of Republicans that he be the nominee. Because that is the populist opinion. It's not taking the position that he doesn't live up to the role.
The issue is, what kind of influence, even if I'd chosen to get involved in the presidential election, what kind of influence would I have had?
You're one of the most powerful Republicans.
I'm the Republican leader of the Senate. What we do here is try to make law. I like us to be in the majority.
Your worldview seems more aligned with Joe Biden when it comes to American leadership in these global conflicts than with Donald Trump.
I certainly
who
wouldn't
has spoken have. Against Volodymyr Zelensky, who has not endorsed the package that you just worked so hard to get over the finish line.
Look, I wouldn't have withdrawn from Afghanistan. I wouldn't have submitted four budgets in a row for defense that don't even keep up with inflation. I got plenty of differences with the current administration. Whether I will have differences with the next administration remains to be seen. I know what I think, and it doesn't make any difference what the outcome of the presidential election is. I'm going to be focusing on this for the remainder of my time in the Senate.
What I hear you saying, tell me if I'm getting it wrong, is that you can stop Donald Trump if he's commander in chief. Even if you're not leader, you're going to do the most you can to counter this isolationist worldview and to counter or limit what he could do if reelected.
I'm going to counter, no matter who's elected president, advocating things that I think are not good for America. What I care about is what does the person who actually gets elected ultimately do?
Should Mr. Trump, as candidate, as representative of your party, go and see Ukraine for himself?
I'm not going to give him any advice. I'm focusing on turning the Senate Republicans into the majority here and focusing on advocating, as I think I successfully did this very week, for moving away from the isolationist movement that began with Tucker Carlson.
It began with Tucker Carlson?
It did. He had a huge audience among rank and file Republicans, and I think it was very destructive, very impactful on regular Republican voters, and created a big problem.
Because he mimicked Republican propaganda and amplified it, and then that's been repeated on the House floor, as the House Intel chairman
said?
Well,
I certainly disagreed with him, and he certainly ended up where he should have been all along, interviewing Vladimir Putin.
Will you fact-check Donald Trump when he says these things? Because he has also repeated some of these
things. I'm not going to give any advice to our candidate in the presidential election. What I'm focusing on is turning the Senate into a majority Republican.
Our full interview with Leader McConnell is on our website and our YouTube channel. We'll be right back.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Our Mark Strassman reports on those college campus protests that have erupted across the country.
All the clamor on campus keeps spreading, a clash of more than ideas. Riot gear at Ohio State. Tasers at Emory University in Atlanta. Mostly pro-Palestinian protesters, at times scuffling with police, waved on by school administrators, with hundreds of arrests. Communities like the University of Texas turning on each other. Israel's war on Hamas has another front line.
Free Palestine!
Let my people go!
A free speech and hate speech campus debate that's anything but academic.
If you want to protect free speech, then you don't break up peaceful protests.
People didn't seem to be aware of how bad the situation for free speech and academic freedom already was on campus until October 7th.
Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a group defending the right to free speech.
Do you have the sense that any of this is moving the ball forward?
Some of the ways the protest has been going on college campuses has been alienating more of the public than bringing it in.
On Columbia University's West Lawn, civil disobedience, this ongoing tent city, galvanized national protests. They want the university to divest investments in Israel and companies they say profit off repression of Palestinians. Dueling protests at Columbia, pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian, reflect a larger welter of opinion and emotion, passion, and perceived prejudice.
People would be up in arms and protesting that right away. But because it's the Jews, I feel like nobody cares.
All this coast-to-coast commotion is well into its second week. And what began here at Columbia has now rippled overseas.
From Paris to London, university students occupied buildings and marched in the streets. They're echoing this U.S. student movement. At times, a moment that's been unflattering, even dark, from intolerant protesters to stumbling universities.
A lot of campuses are teaching young people to think like activists and less like scholars. When you're reduced to just shouting at each other, that is a failure of some of the things that makes higher education so special.
Welcome back to Face the Nation and the kickoff of our 2024 Battleground Tracker polls. Our CBS News battlegrounds are those seven key states where things could go either way. Today, we're looking at three of them that Biden won in 2020, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In effect, Trump and Biden are running even. The former president is up one percentage point in two of those states, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. The current president is up two over Trump in Michigan. Joining us now is our executive director of elections and surveys, Anthony Salvanto. So, Anthony, why are they so close if Biden won them in 2020?
The reason this time is I just asked people to start the campaign. How do these candidates make you feel? And the top answer for each of them was worried. Then you look at the Biden numbers particularly, and he gets feelings of insecurity, which could be kind of tough for a sitting president, although calm is one that accrues to his benefit. But then for Trump, you get feelings of anger, right? That's particularly true for Democrats, also some insecurity, and neither one of them does very well on eliciting confidence.
Economy is always issue number one for voters. Mm-hmm. How is it faring in these three states?
And it is, again, here. But what's interesting is this story starts back in 2020. When we polled these states, at the time the pandemic was going on, people then said the economy in those states was bad. So we asked them now, okay, has it gotten better? And very few people say that it has. In fact, many say they feel it's gotten worse. And inflation is the reason that they say that. But what's also interesting is we ask them, okay, look back to the economy during the Trump years. Mm-hmm. How do you remember it? And the majority say they remember it as being good.
Because they forget about the pandemic.
Well, they seem to be skipping over the pandemic. And that's exactly what that tells you in their memory of this. But it also explains now when you ask them, okay, now let's look forward. They say, more say, they feel they'd be financially better off under Donald Trump. And that cuts directly to vote. And that is helping the former president.
So in these three particular states, access to abortion is legally protected. How much of a motivator will it be then for voters there to actually go to the polls?
That's probably the key question. It is for Democrats. What you see is these other states where there has been abortion laws, Arizona with that 1864 law, Florida with their law going into effect, their ban, you know, 6-week ban going into effect. Voters in these states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, say they're watching what's happening in those states. So what's happening there, it's not staying there in their minds. And what's important there is it becomes a national issue. And so here we see, especially for Democrats, when they are saying they feel angry that Roe v. Wade was overturned, they're voting overwhelmingly for Joe Biden. But for the ones who say abortion should be legal, but they're not angry about this, they're dissatisfied, they're unhappy about it, the race is much closer. And what that tells you is, for the Biden campaign in particular, it's going to be an exercise in motivation. It's going to be trying to put that issue even higher on the issues list. And that is the big thing on which their, you know, fortunes might hinge.
Anthony Salvanto, thank you.
Thank you.
We go now to Democratic Congresswoman Summer Lee. She joins us from her district in Pittsburgh. Good morning to you, Congresswoman.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You just heard our CBS polling in reference to your home state. I know last weekend Governor Shapiro told us if President Biden's pause on natural gas permits goes on a long time, it'll cost Pennsylvania jobs. And we're seeing in our polling the perception that Donald Trump would be better, 49% of voters said, than Joe Biden, 33%, on these oil and gas exploration issues. This seems to be a headwind for Democrats in your state. Are you concerned?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be concerned about, right? I think that when we look at these polls, you know, we'll pull out one issue at a time. But the reality is that there are a number of issues mixed together that make voters feel confident, that make voters, some other voters feel hopeless or feel like maybe there's a little reason to participate. And I think that we're dealing with that a lot, right? When we talk to voters throughout my election, we talk to a lot of voters who, whether it's the economy, the price of, you know, goods, gas, food, things of that nature, or abortion, like all of these different issues made voters feel like there was very little options that they had and that they didn't want to participate. And we have to figure out something very quickly to address that.
In your primary, which you won, your Democratic challenger's point of attack was your willingness to break with President Biden in his unequivocal support for Israel with its war with Hamas in Gaza. You've called for a ceasefire. If you believe that this is such a matter of conscience and so important, can you truly ask progressive voters to go and vote for Joe Biden in November?
Yeah, I think that we do that every year. Every 2 years, we ask voters, progressive voters, we ask black and brown voters, young voters, we ask them to weigh the totality of our options, right? The totality of a candidate, the totality of the things that we care about, that we come to the polling places with. And that's not new, right? This is an issue that gets a lot of issue. And there are going to be, very reasonably, a lot of people who will feel apprehension about that. And I think that is not a foregone conclusion that there's just nothing that Democrats can do. When we look at an election like mine, we've seen how popular it is to take a pro-peace stance, how popular it is to call for a different direction in the policies that the United States has towards the war in Gaza, towards sending unconditional weapons, offensive weapons to Netanyahu. And our government still has time to react. We still have time to listen to the folks who have feelings about that. And that's what we have to do.
So you went to meet with some of the campus protesters out in Pittsburgh recently. You were in support of some of those young people who have chosen to protest against what's happening in Gaza. Do you hear from them that they're excited to go vote for Joe Biden?
To be honest, you know, we don't. It's not a topic that, you know, always comes up, but it does a lot. I think that the number one goal for them right now, you know, just listening to what they had to say, is that they want to see a ceasefire in Gaza. They want to see the indiscriminate bombings and killings end, right? That is the reason why they're out. And there's a lot of noise around this that distracts from that. There's a lot of noise that tries to take away from that central message. But that is the central thing that they are fighting for. And they believe and they feel like our government can do more. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for some sort of acknowledgement from our leadership that they hear our needs, that they hear these young people saying that we want our country, we want our government to go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear you clearly distinguishing between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel. But some people, and I'm sure you know this, hear criticism and understand it as anti-Semitic when it is critical of Israel. The prime minister of Israel said that what's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. He said the protesters are anti-Semitic mobs, and he compared it to what's happening in German universities back in the 1930s. How do you respond to that, or the perception of that, perhaps among some of your constituents?
Certainly. You know, his language is intentional, and it's always been. But the one thing that I know is that Benjamin Netanyahu has not been on a college campus in the United States. He has not talked to these students. He has not seen their encampments. He has not seen or heard the message that they're delivering, and he doesn't want to hear it, right? His number one goal is, you know, what he's doing over there. And anything that that harms or helps or makes it harder for him to achieve that goal, he's going to distract from. But this idea that every criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic is dangerous. There is a fair critique that we must make of every government, of every war, of every appropriation. And when we say that students who are engaging in the time-honored tradition of civil disobedience, of campus protests and action are inherently bad or inherently anti-Semitic, particularly as we see Jewish students standing in solidarity with Muslim students or Arab students and Black students, when you're on the ground, you see that all of those students have been working together or have been learning and educating together. And they are all in one voice crying for a difference in direction, particularly from Benjamin Netanyahu. So I'm not shocked that he would want to cast them as evil, cast them as in the wrong. That's been his MO.
Congresswoman, thank you for explaining what's happening within your party and your position. We'll have to leave it right there. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And we're joined now by the founding director of the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, University of Chicago, Professor Robert Pape, who has new findings on the college protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Welcome back to the program. I understand you've been surveying about 5,000 students, 600 colleges and universities between December and January, because this stretches back to right after October 7th. What did you learn about what's happening?
The big thing we learned is that the feelings of fear on college campuses are more widespread and more intense than we have known. Overall, 56% of Jewish students report feeling in personal danger. Close behind, 52% of Muslim students report feeling in personal danger. And 16% of all students who are not Jewish and not Muslim, this is 2 to 3 million college students, also report feeling in personal danger. We also asked them in text boxes why, and over 1,000 students told us why. And what they're reporting, Margaret, is not TikTok. What they are reporting is observing acts of physical violence and intimidation right in front of them. Jewish students are seeing Jewish buildings attacked. Muslim students are seeing people counterattack against Muslims. The students that are not Jewish and not Muslim, they're just seeing everybody getting attacked. Also, protest chants are playing a role. So what we are seeing in general is that this is not fading away. This is a direct function of the escalation in the Middle Eastern conflict over there, and this is having spillover effects on our campuses and, of course, in some cities.
Well, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, went up to Columbia University this week. You had four Democratic lawmakers, all Jewish, who went, they said, in solidarity with Jewish students there and threatened to withhold federal funding. Is that kind of political involvement helpful, or is it putting fuel on the fire?
It is putting fuel on the fire because it's so one-sided. If Speaker Johnson had gone together with Hakeem Jeffries with an actual plan to bring calm, and we'll talk about what that might look like, then this is a different story. But by making it a surprise, by making threats, you know, if you don't do X, we will fire Y, and we're going to do X, and this is all a surprise, this is actually not helpful for crowd control at all. So I also study the actual violent part of this. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing when you have protests and that are building is don't do a surprise. In Portland during the George Floyd protests, you might remember DHS surprised Portland. That escalated things. This is a very bad idea. So you need to have a more thoughtful approach to calming tensions that go beyond crowd control and that are not simply one side is right, everybody else is wrong, and we're going to hammer it through until we win.
So who is that first line of action coming from? Is it university presidents, or are you talking about law enforcement?
There are roles here for university presidents, law enforcement, and national leaders. And actually, talking to law enforcement here directly in folks who do this in Chicago, law enforcement's actually much more sophisticated, I think, than you might see from the national leader. So that's why I think it's so important to focus on the solutions from the perspective of our university leaders, our national leaders, because they are only episodically involved with dealing with violence and political violence. And that's really why it's so important to focus on what our university leaders should be doing and our national leaders beyond simply crowd control. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you're saying people have forgotten how to have a civil conversation about a heated issue.
Well,
and isn't that what university is supposed to be about?
They are, but no, October 7 caught all of us by surprise, and it caught universities by surprise. So we are simply, we have policies. We have policies of the Calvin Report at the University of Chicago. These were many of the campus policies and our practices developed in the 1960s. And almost no leader who's running either our government or our university was involved in the 1960s. And the issues we're dealing with today are new. Mm-hmm. They're not completely new, but I would say like 90 degrees new. And that is what we have to come to grips with and not just assume everything was fine before, so right. They will just fade away and they will be fine again.
There's a lot of focus on the physical protests right now, but going back to October, you had those three Palestinian boys shot in Burlington, Vermont. You had congressional hearings grilling college university leaders for not reining in language used on campus. I mean, this has been going on for 6 months now. Does it stop when the school year ends?
I don't think we can count on that for several reasons. Number one, we have graduation season to get through. Number two, many of our colleges now have summer programs that are quite extensive. So for many colleges and universities, things don't completely come to a halt during the summer, but also next fall. Fall is not that far away. And this could also happen again. It could happen in the middle of our election season as well. So there are many, many reasons, the Chicago Convention. There are many reasons why we should take calming steps now. And again, not just keep assuming, oh, yeah, everything's fine. We just need to get through the next day or two or the next week or two, and then things will just fade away. I think that was an assumption by many quite important and credible leaders. That assumption now needs to be pushed aside.
Professor, thank you for your insights. We'll be back in a moment.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We want to take a closer look at the growing humanitarian crisis when it comes to the world's children. Catherine Russell is the executive director of UNICEF, and she is just back from Israel and the West Bank. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Margaret. Good to be here.
I know you met with some of the families of Israeli children who are still being held hostage. Mm-hmm. There's a one-year-old, there's a four-year-old. Yeah. And you met with Israeli officials about access for aid going into Gaza. Mm-hmm. Did you get any good answers?
Well, we got some good answers, which is that I think a growing awareness of how critical it was for us to get more aid in, and specifically what we needed, more access points, better security. You know, I'm certainly not the only person who made those arguments and advocated with the government of Israel, but we have seen a little bit of an improvement in Gaza, so that's a positive that came from it. Obviously, the needs still far, far outweigh what we're able to do, but at least we've seen some progress.
You also went to the Palestinian West Bank, and 2023 was the deadliest year for children in the West Bank since they began monitoring at the UN in 2005. Mm-hmm. With all of the attention on Gaza, tell me what's happening to kids in the West Bank right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first day I met with, as you said, the hostage families. Second day I was on the West Bank and heard there about, excuse me, the challenges children face every day, just trying to get to school, the barriers they face, the difficulty in sort of moving around, the checkpoints, all the rest of it. And
Israeli
as you said, yes, and as you said, there is an increase in violence. And I think just in this year alone, there have been 40 odd children, Palestinian children killed, two Israeli children killed. There's just an uptick in violence. And it's, as always, children who are really impacted by that. You also mentioned, you know, I met with the hostage families. I mean, they're devastated by what's going on. Some children still being held, others who are traumatized either by being held themselves or by seeing family members killed and hurt. And I think I would just say that overall, I came back feeling like there's just so much pain and misery everywhere you look. And it's really unfortunate to see it, and just praying for a better day for everyone in the situation.
The UN says every 10 minutes a child is killed or wounded in Gaza. I mean, that just hits you in the chest when you hear that.
Yeah, it's a shocking number.
It's horrific.
It is what's happening. Yeah.
And the U.S. called this week for an investigation of this mass grave that was just found in Gaza of hundreds of people. Were there children there? What do you know?
Yeah, we don't. UNICEF doesn't know much about that, honestly. I think that I would say a couple things. One, there needs to be a full investigation of what happened. And I think that at some point will certainly, I hope, take place. And second, to me, it argues again for the importance of having international press in Gaza. I say this over and over again because you have disputes about what has actually happened, what's going on. And I think not, you know, look, there are incredibly brave Palestinian reporters and press people there who are doing an incredible job. Many of them have suffered so much. People have been killed. I think having the international press in there is also really important. And I hope that that changes sometime soon and international press folks can get in, really make their own assessments of what's going on.
And if the Israeli government allows for it,
exactly.
I think a lot of news organizations
exactly.
would absolutely.
And they should
go
be there.
In.
They should be seeing what's happening.
The U.S. military, as you know, is setting up this port that's mm-hmm. supposed to be open sometime in May. Mm-hmm. We had Doctors Without Borders chief on recently, yeah. and she said to me, "There's a slow motion massacre of people suffering from deprivation of food and water for 6 months in time. You can't drop lentils from the yeah. sky," is what she said.
True.
"You need a mass medical response. Is there any plan in place to do this, to revive some of these children who are starving to death?
Yeah.
And will it come before there is an invasion of Rafah?"
Well, let me say a couple things. One, the humanitarian situation, especially for children, is incredibly worrying everywhere. We know in the north where it's been very difficult for humanitarians to get in with food. And as you're pointing out, children in particular need what we talk about as therapeutic feeding, right? So they need Plumpy Nut or sort of interventions by medical professionals. So it's not, as you say, just dropping in food. That's not enough. We need to do more for little children. It is definitely not anywhere near where it needs to be. I think that the idea of the port, the idea of airdrops, you know, all, look, we support is getting as much aid in as we possibly can. But the truth is, the most important thing is getting more and more in through road access. That's the best access. It's the safest access. Mm-hmm. It's the best for humanitarians, and it's the easiest way for us to actually get around. Having said that, it's very difficult to do that for so many reasons, not least of which the roads are all torn up, right? We have security issues. So it's a challenging, sort of array of problems.
Yeah.
And I think we need multiple ways to try to respond to it.
Please tell me what is happening in Sudan, which is the biggest displacement crisis in the world for children right now.
Sudan is terrible for children. It is, as you say, the largest displacement. Millions of children are on the move. Almost no children are in school. I think 90% of children are out of school. There's incredible violence, including sexual violence, that children are suffering and witnessing. Children are suffering from malnutrition. It's absolutely a devastating situation, and we all need to pay more attention to it, for sure.
And these are the next generations that we are talking about.
You know what, Margaret, that's the thing about working with children, right? It's like, on the one hand, they're so vulnerable to everything that happens to them. And, you know, you mentioned Rafah. I mean, if there's an incursion into Rafah, that's unimaginable to imagine what the violence will be like and how they will suffer. But whether it's in Gaza or in Sudan or Haiti or so many other places, children are suffering so much. And we all talk about children of the future. Well, okay, then we need to protect them. We need to make sure that they are educated and healthy and have some decent future ahead. And that's critical for them, and it's critical for their countries, and it's critical for all of humanity.
Catherine Russell, thank you. Thanks. For your insights today. We'll be right back. That's it for us today. Thank you all for watching. Until next week. For Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were Hannah Siegel, the sister of American-Israeli hostage Keith Siegel, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, CBS Surveys and Elections Executive Director Anthony Salvanto, Democratic Congresswoman Summer Lee of Pennsylvania, University of Chicago Professor Robert Pape, and Executive Director of UNICEF Catherine Russell. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Shelley Schwartz. Face the Nation originates in CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our CBS News streaming network on Sundays at 1:30, 4, 10 p.m. Eastern, and again at 4 a.m. the next morning. And it's available through our apps, CBS News and Paramount Plus.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.